Message from the House.
February the 1st, 2011, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill 37, State Archive Storage Study, ayes 51, noes 7, excused 2. House Bill 61, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill 154, Multiple Special Handicap License Plates, ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill 160, Management Audit Committee Subpoena Power, ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill 152, Very Rare or Uncommon Area Designations, ayes 45, noes 13, excused 2. February the 1st, 2011, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill 182, Student Assessment Measures, ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. House Bill 35, Health Care Choice and Protection Act, ayes 44, noes 14, excused 2. House Bill 49, Primary Care Support Program, Substitute Number 1, ayes 47, noes 11, excused 2. And House Joint Resolution 6, Private Property Protection, ayes 57, noes 1, excused 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
House bills on first reading. House Bill 160, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill 160, Management Audit Committee Subpoena Power, an act relating to legislative oversight, sponsored by the Management Audit Committee. Pass the House on 58 and ayes 58, excused 2.
House Bill 160 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 61, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill 61, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, an act relating to water development projects, sponsored by the Water Committee. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 58, excused 2.
House Bill 61 has been referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 152, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill 152, Very Rare or Uncommon Area Designations, and Act Relating to the Environmental Quality Act, sponsored by Representative Semlich. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 45, noes 13, excused 2.
House Bill 152 has been referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. House Bill 37, first reading of the House bill.
House Bill 37, State Archive Storage Study, an act relating to state archives, sponsored by the Travel Committee. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 51, noes 7, excused 2.
House Bill 37 has been referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. House Bill 154.
House Bill 154, Multiple Special Handicap License Plates, an act relating to motor vehicle registration, sponsored by Representative Harvey. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 58, excused 2.
House Bill 154 has been referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Reports from standing committees.
January the 31st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 8, committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 135, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas Peterson, Von Flatren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 104, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass failed in accordance with Senate Rule 7.3. Aye, Senator Hastert, noes, Senator Meyer, Nicholas Peterson, Von Flatren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 131, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas Peterson, Von Flatren, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation Elections and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 113, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 150, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 7, Corporation, Elections, and Political Subdivision, to whom was referred Senate File 147, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Martin, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 100, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll. No, Senator Escobel. Excuse, Senator Christensen, Senator Burns, Chairman. February 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred House Bill 76, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll, Escobel, excuse, Senator Christensen, Senator Burns, Chairman. February 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 60, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Barnard, Case, Emmerich, Hines, and Perkins, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business, consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. Senator Peterson, would you like to return to the chair?
The whole come to order, and we have first bill for our consideration is Senate File 134. The reading clerk will read in the Senate file.
Senate File 134, Liens, an act relating to liens, sponsored by Senator Perkins. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise reports that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 134, liens, for an explanation of the bill. If the Chairman will indulge me, I'll go ahead and explain the bill. Now, what we've got here, if you remember, and just to put this into context, if you remember, a year ago we had a significant lien bill. One of the things that we decided to do on this floor at the suggestion, if I remember right, as one of the good senator from Sheridan, if I remember right, had suggested that we put a delayed effective date on that, which we did. So the lien statute that we put into effect doesn't become law or effective until July the 1st of 2011. During that time, one of the things was that we could go out and get some feedback from individuals about what might need to be changed in this law in what we did last year. And I bring to you Senate File 134, which is going out and listening to people and some of the concerns that they had about the bill that we passed last time and the opportunity to correct it before it becomes effective this summer. So what we've got is a bill, 134, has three changes in it. First of all, it modifies the definition of the term send or sent. When we talked about this, it was intended that, and if you remember, what one of the requirements is for a subcontractor or a materialman or a contractor to be able to have a lien against the owner of property, they have to provide them with notice that they have that unless they are paid, that they'll have the right to file a lien against that property, and also notify them that they can avoid that by obtaining lien releases or verifying that they indeed have been paid. In doing that, one of the things that we said was that we wanted to have contractors and material men and subcontractors be able to send that by first-class mail. When we go back in the definition of send, first-class mail was not in there. It was either going to have to be sent. It could be sent electronically. It could be sent by overnight courier. It could be sent by certified mail, return receipt requested, or mail delivery requiring some kind of receipt for delivery. But it was always intended during the discussions that it would be include first-class mail. So the first thing you see on page 2 of line 13 is we include first-class mail in the definitions of sent, so that can do that. That takes care of that. The second issue was a weakness that was identified is on page 3. And what that had to do with the new law requires or puts an obligation on the contractor to provide subcontractors and material men the name and address of the record owner or his agent, so that they would know where to send that notice to that they have the right to file a lien if they're not paid. The problem with that was there was never anything that happened, or there's never any incentive for the contractor to do that. There's no penalty or anything happening to the contractor who doesn't provide that information. So the suggestion was, and what this bill does on the bottom of page 3, is it makes if a contractor fails to give that notice that he's required to under law, then the contractor will lose the right to be able to file a lien against the property. The concept is simply what sauce for the goose, Mr. Chairman, should be sauce for the gander. The third correction is simply an oversight or a typographical error in one of the statutory forms. Pages 4 and 5 is a portion of the statutory notice for intention to file a lien. And what you have there is in the new 29-2-107, it provided that notice had to be provided within 20 days. However, the form, as you see on page 5, on lines 13 and 14, had a 30-day notice in the statutory notice form. And so the change there just makes that to conform with what's in the existing statute, which is 20 days, so that both the form and the underlying statute that requires that are consistent. That's the bill, and that's what the intent is and the purposes are, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration. We'll stand for questions.
Senator Perkins, there is a committee of the whole amendment. Did you move that?
I forgot about it, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like to move that now? Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole amendment.
Senate File 134, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 14.
There it is.
Senator Perkins.
Here it is, Mr. Chairman. It's on the bottom of the stack. Mr. Chairman, I'd move Standing Committee Amendment, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 134. And looking at after it got out of committee, what we did is the language in there had this first-class postage prepaid, and that wasn't quite the way it was supposed to work. It's just first-class mail. So what the amendment does is it clarifies or cleans up that language so that it will be by first-class mail
by certified mail, return receipt requested, or by mail delivery requiring receipt for delivery. So that's all. It doesn't really change anything. It just cleans up that language because we had a postage prepaid, some words out there were just kind of hanging out there, and not sure why I let that get through the first time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask our colleague from Natrona County a little bit more about these geese. As I understand this, then, a contractor who is contracted with the owner, who would ordinarily have a direct contract with the owner, could sue the owner for non-payment, but let's assume there's a bank loan out there. So the contractor does $1 million worth of work. At the end of the project, he files mechanics lien because he's never been paid. Now the owner goes back and starts searching to find out that maybe he subcontracted a couple $100,000 of work to subcontractors. They were paid, but since the owner shows, hey, show me where you sent your notifications to the subs, he can't produce it, so he's lost his lien right. Is that the notion here?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the notion. The notion is that if the contractor doesn't provide that notice of the record owner under the laws it is now, if he doesn't provide that who the record owner is and what the address of the record owner is, then ultimately the materialman and the subcontractor probably lose a significant right in the ability to file that lien. Right now, unless you have some kind of right now, in the bills it is that if a contractor does that and he could purposefully not provide that information to a materialman or a subcontractor, and yet there's nothing that happens to him. So ultimately, if the subcontractors and materialmen lose their right to have a lien because the contractor hasn't complied with that statutory right, then it would seem, then that's exactly what it does, is the contractor loses that right to file a lien as well. It doesn't mean he can't enforce the contract. Doesn't mean he can't take other steps to make sure he gets paid, but he would lose his right to file a lien. Yes.
Senator Bebow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, and on to that very point. As I recall the statutes on liens, you got 180 days for a mechanics lien. Everybody has that same right to be able to file a lien if they're not going to get paid. And a lot of times, if you're the general contractor on the materialman, that's so broad and there's all kinds of material. It could very well be that you have 10 houses going on at one particular time, so you buy all the lumber from one individual lumber yard. So that would be, I guess, your materialman. And how do you know that, in fact, that you've notified them? I guess you would do a blanket notification to them that says we're going to buy this lumber possibly for all of these different homes, so we want to give you that right. But ultimately, I don't know why we want to take away the right of the general contractor to file a lien, because if for some way he might have overlooked a materialman that might have supplied a small component to that house, I'm not sure why you want to do that. I'm missing that. The other thing, Mr. Chairman, as we talk about in the event of the writing in first class, and is this getting into the area of, a lot of times it's very critical as to timing when you file these notifications. Is this a way of saying that, well, I sent it by first-class mail, and you may not have got it, but, oh, yes, I did send it, so therefore I don't have to worry about these timing issues?
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you. I guess to follow up on this, you know, part of the problem that I see in these statutes is you've got commercial projects and you've got home projects. And if you go out and build a home and you go out and you've got a general contractor, he may not even have a written contract. He calls up the plumber. The plumber goes over, and in most instances, the plumber's working with the owner, and the plumber knows exactly who the owner is because the owner may be standing there. And now you say, as a result of an inadvertence, he loses his subcontract rights. On commercial projects, large projects, generally speaking, if it's the state of the Wyoming, you walk in there, and there's a big sign there that says, here's the owner. I understand the reason why we put the original language in there was just to make sure that contractors gave notification to the subs on how to file a lien. But if the sub's not getting paid, he can walk down to the courthouse and find out who the owner is and send a notification to the owner. And so while we wanted to require the contractor to do it, subcontractors and material men, it seems to me, know what they need to do to perfect their liens. They know that if somebody's not giving them the right name, they can go down to the courthouse and look up who the record owner is, so that the likelihood of injury to a sub and a material man is so small, and the opportunity for the contractor to inadvertently not send out a notice is so great, and he's really not done anything terribly wrong. And for him to lose the opportunity to file the mechanics lien, the owner goes broke, he can't pay the bills, the property's out there, the bank takes over the property, and the bank now just got the benefit of all that work for free. So I wonder if it's a punishment that doesn't meet the arise to the level of offense that we're going to charge him with.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, to go back and answer the question about what you have in sin, if you look at the bottom of the definition of sin that's in existing statute, it's deemed sin when it's deposited in the mailbox. So if you've sent that notice, that's going to be an effort for a fact for you to prove, and you'll have to prove that however you can prove that. But that's included in the definition of the word send. And so in the overall act we did last year, we intentionally used the word send or sent so that would conform with that definition. In the discussions last year, it was always intended that regular first class mail would be included in that. And then when we went out and we looked at that, we found out that lo and behold, it wasn't there. With respect to the good chairman from Albany County, I mean, you can make that decision, and that's a value judgment. We made this value judgment last year. We had many of the same arguments last year. If you don't like that provision, bring a second reading amendment to pull it out of there, and we can have that debate if we think that's inappropriate. These are the weaknesses as we went out, and kind of what the charge was with the effective date delayed was we go out and find out what the feedback was. This is the feedback, and I'm bringing you the feedback that I got. I was surprised we only had these three, but those are the three that came, and so those are the ones that are in the bill. With respect to the general contractor, oftentimes the general contractor may have the overall, there are oftentimes subs who are such significant portions that the value of the work done by subs and material men can far exceed the rights and the obligations that are there by the general contractor. The general contractor may have that obligation to pay them, but ultimately the general contractor's actual work and effort and materials that the general contractor has in a project may not be anywhere near the amount that subcontractors have. And so, oftentimes general contractors really are nothing more than managing a series of subcontractors, and that's where the value of the work is. So you can make that determination one way or the other, and certainly if that is bothersome to some, I would suggest that we bring that. Again, I don't particularly have strong feelings either way about it. That wasn't a weakness that was identified in the bill, and we brought it to you that way. Thank you.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more question about this. If, in fact, you're trying to protect the subcontractor or the material man, and so you're going to get back at the general contractor for them not letting you have that information, at least if the general contractor had the right to file the lien, he would be protecting what's owed to them by him by going after the owner. So I'm not sure that would be of concern to me, too. So you take away that right if the subcontractor or material men are not paid of the general contractor, who obviously owes the money, of going after the owner and be able to perfect a lien.
Just a reminder to the body, we are we need to address the amendment, the committee, the whole amendment. Are you ready for the question on the amendment? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion to adopt the committee of the whole amendment number 1 to Senate file 134, please say aye. Opposed, no. The amendment passes. Back on the bill. Any further discussion? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 134, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That Senate file passes. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor, please?
You may.
Mr. Chairman, I don't take it generally, but this is a special occasion. This is a threefer we got here. We've got up in the South Balcony, we have a number of college trustees, which we should make welcome. Also up in the South Balcony, we have the former Supreme Court Administrator, Holly Hansen, sitting there, which I'm thrilled about. Oh, no, we don't. I thought it was her, my mistake. And down here, on the North Bench, we've got former Representative Jerry Eichel, who's not only former representative, but he also happens to be the husband of our nurse of the day. So please make them all welcome.
Welcome all to the better dressed, better looking half of the Capitol. Thank you, Senator Burns. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 136. The reading clerk will read in the Senate file.
Senate File 136, Water Source of Supply, an act relating to water rights, sponsored by Senator Meyer. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agricultural, State and Public Lands and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, and Hicks. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Senator Geis.
When the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that Senate File 136 do pass, and I'd also like to move the Standing Committee Amendments.
Senate File 136, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 8.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Geis.
I'll yield the floor to Senator Meyer to explain the amendment and the bill.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I bring you this bill after quite a little bit of work over the course of the year here. As you recall, last year we put forth in the budget a hydrological study plan that was down in my neck of the woods down there in Goshen County. And in the plan, this is some of the stuff that the state engineer may be looking at. I did quite a little bit of study as far as some of the other plans and different hydrological studies throughout the state in this regard, and found that perhaps we wanted to give some direction to the state engineer as far as using credible and accurate site-specific data. In the Standing Committee amendments, we might talk about that for a second. I realize that was pretty constrictive by just saying only consider. Brought that to attention of the committee, and they decided to strike the word only on line 8. And I guess with explanation on that Standing Committee amendment, I'd have us vote on that at this point in time.
Question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt the Standing Committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 136, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. That amendment has passed. On the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think in the matter of full disclosure, our place is in this area where the study is taking place. We have several water rights in there. I've got surface water rights to basically mitigate any damages or anything we may have on our wells, but I've got a lot of neighbors in that area that don't have surface water rights. And so I wanted to make sure that in this case that, and in any case, that we would have credible data on these decisions and these determinations if they were to be made. And I think it's important that in anything we do, especially in water, that if you're going to make a decision on water rights, that'll be done with credible and accurate data. And with that explanation, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for stand for questions and ask for your favorable consideration.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Further discussion on the bill? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I have a major personal problem with this bill. Let me explain. This bill, at least as it would apply to our area, is in the nature of the disputes between surface water rights and underground water rights. You can also get into a dispute between two different underground water rights, but as it would affect our area, it relates to the surface against the ground rights. And the surface water rights are senior priorities, almost entirely senior to the groundwater rights. The nature, you know, the original pioneers used open ditches and gravity flood irrigation and not wells and pivots. The situation on our little creek, there were a number of wells drilled, big agriculture wells put in pivots. They've drilled 100 feet or so into the aquifer. The aquifer and the creek appear to be interconnected. And in the dry years, they in fact dried the creek right up. And the surface water rights were harmed. We requested the regulation the way we do in most years in our creek. Didn't do any good. The water was gone, been pumped. And there had been some earlier studies that were general studies of that aquifer that led the state engineer to declare a moratorium on new underground permits, but they didn't do that till the cat was out of the bag, and a number of these wells, in fact, existed. And what happened was the state engineer ruled that the sources were interconnected. There was a court case over that, and it lost in district court, and the regulation prevailed, and the surface rights can shut and do shut the wells off. What this bill is doing is, and the difficulty you have, is that because you can't see the water, it is difficult to prove that there is an interconnection and that, in fact, the wells are drawing the creek down. I'm absolutely convinced in our case that's what happened. It dried the creek up so it didn't start running again till February, one of those years, when it normally runs all winter. But what I'm afraid of is that, and this is, Mr. Chairman, why I'm going to declare a conflict of interest on this bill. What I'm afraid of is that some of the new underground wells are owned by wealthy individuals who can perfectly well say, look, the legislature has changed the standard, changed the law in this respect. Let's go back to court for another throw of the dice. Next time there's a regulation request, you'll get a new case. And that may well destroy the value in part, in major part, of our 1886 water right. So, Mr. Chairman, this bill gets real personal and hits some of us with senior surface water rights. It's at the value of what we've got. Now, the Standing Committee Amendment, I think, improved things, but I don't think it solved the problem. And so, therefore, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to declare a conflict because this one could cost me a major portion of the value of my ranch, and I don't think I can be objective on the subject. I may lobby you plenty, but I can't be objective.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, I urge the Senate to go very, very cautiously with this bill. You just heard an example of what can happen. What you're doing, you're making a major change in water law. And I'm not going to use any specific example, but when you hear about a ranch, the major productivity of which is tied up in an 1876 water right, saying this bill threatens that water right, folks, I urge you to go cautious. Understand also, when you start talking about the interconnectivity between the surface and the groundwater, part of that's done measuring that watershed. That is not an exact science. And I'll just suggest to you, if you want a part of the magnitude, the watershed that I'm on goes from, south of Powder River, what is that, the Rattlesnake Mountains down there somewhere, comes north, and it goes all the way to the Montana line. And, of course, then we fight with Montana from there on. Going north, it goes clear up to Piney Creek where they killed poor old Fetterman. You know, it's a mammoth stretch of country. And that doesn't include Little Powder and going down towards southern Campbell County. In fact, in great part, you have to model it. That's what you do. You model it. What this is doing is undermining that modeling. In addition, and it was mentioned earlier, if you go in and do some drilling and have a study on that underground aquifer, the groundwater, probably if you're wealthy enough, rigs are pretty cheap right now, particularly those little rigs, you can probably do it, and you can overturn Wyoming water law as we have known it, and as we have made it work since the second rain cloud that came through, I think, is when it took effect. I mean, it's been there a long time. It works. This is undermining it. Take a look at it, read it, but I urge you go very, very carefully with this bill. It's a fundamental change to what we've worked out over all those years, and that has worked and maintained value in our ranches.
Thank you, Senator Schiffer. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we should go careful when we do water law. There's no doubt about it. I will say that when the state engineer testified on this, he said he could not have it, that has no argument with the language that we put forth. That's what the state engineer said. And if we look at it from the standpoint, and simply I have to agree with Senator Scott, that if there is credible site-specific data that someone develops, and which is contrary to the model which made a ruling on the regulation, then yes, that ruling could be reversed. And so should we ask ourselves, basically, if you have credible site, accurate site-specific data, whether or not that's more valid than a model? And so that's the question you ask. And in some cases, it may be that you have credible data, and we're saying that the state engineer shall consider that credible site-specific data when they make these decisions. Now, the difference might be on a model, or you may have modeled the North Platte River. And a model may say on the North Platte River you have a river that is a quarter to three-quarters of a mile wide. And you may have an alluvial aquifer that stretches out a mile to 2 miles on each side of the North Platte River. Now, to say that that model is more valid than credible site-specific data by itself, perhaps would draw you to a conclusion that we would say, no, that model is not more accurate than data derived and a model derived using the data within that particular location. And so that's what we're saying to the state engineer, that when you make these determinations, that you have to have a basis of it on it. And that basis, in part, has to be credible and accurate data that's in the model, that in the area that has to be regulated. And so that's the difference. There really is no difference in the way the state engineer most probably would apply Wyoming's water law. This is just saying that when you make that decision to the state engineer, that you've got to have something that actually ties it to that particular site, that particular area. So we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater in this one. Basically, what we're saying is that go ahead and model if you want to model. That's fine. But in that model, you have to have something that's actually tied to reality. And the reality is, in that circumstances, is whether or not there's interconnection between your surface water and your groundwater and your wells. And in that situation, as the good senator, tall senator from Natrona said, that there is credible data that suggests that the wells drew down the aquifer and the creek did not run till February, that would be considered credible data, which would weigh on the good tall senators from Natrona County to his advantage. Now, should the state engineer ignore that? Because that's site-specific data. Or should he or somebody develop a model that says that data is irrelevant? And if that data is irrelevant to the specific sites, then any model I'll submit to you, if you want to have an outcome, you can develop a model that has any outcome you wish to have. But if you develop a model and it has some site-specific data, as a tall senator from Natrona County said, the water went down. It did not, the stream did not come up for 3 or 4 months after it normally comes, due primarily to the drop in the water table. That's site-specific data that would validate the use of that data within a model. And so the question really is, Mr. Chairman, is whether or not we're going to have water rights that are going to be affected based on a model of the North Platte River, or water rights that's going to be affected based on the site and by modeling or however, but based on some data, incredible data, where the regulation is actually going to take place. And so, Mr. Chairman, as I said before, the state engineer could not argue, agreed with the credible and accurate data. I mean, how else would you make a decision? Would you make a decision based on incredible data and inaccurate data? You know, so, you know, I think it's almost humorous from the standpoint that a decision would be based on that. But it shouldn't solely be based on a model where there's nothing that ties it back to the specific site. And so I would ask for your favorable consideration. I certainly think we can have some good discussions that would go on longer than the time really permitted on this floor to discuss the different things that can happen in an aquifer or the interrelation and interconnected there too.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, what is it? Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. We're good at it in Powder River, I'll tell you that. Mr. Chairman, do not lose sight of what this bill's doing. This bill goes to the way that you regulate flows of water. That's what they're talking about in 41.3.9.16. And what happens is, as they start regulating, somebody's head gets turned off. They lose a crop. It's that simple. Somebody else's remains on. Their crop will flourish. This is the lifeblood of any river bottom ranch in Wyoming. This is what you're talking about. And don't be dissuaded about credible this. And, you know, the opposite of credible is baloney. And as you know, I sometimes have another word for that. But do not be distracted by that. We're talking about whose head gate is on and whose is off. And I agree with my colleague, if you're wealthy enough and you can come in and hire some people, you can claim to have, quote, credible data. And that is not the way it works. The ditch rider comes by top to bottom and adjudicates the water by priority. If I've got an 1892 water right, I'm ahead of the Sahara Ditch, which is the big canal in our area. Theirs is 1904 or something, I don't know. So my ditch will be on. Theirs will be shut down partway, depending on what the flow actually is. Even if they come in and do drilling or water studies or stuff, it's the flow in the ditch. And you're fooling around with that, the flow in the river that gets diverted to the ditch. You're undermining that. Be very careful when you do that, which is really my utmost polite way of saying, this is not good water policy we're going down. It really isn't. It's going to favor a user that cannot get in and get all the water they want. And the way this will result is you will have streams that normally flow at least during the irrigation season. It's possible to dry them up, I believe what we heard. I've seen it done on tributaries to Powder River. This is serious stuff. I urge you, don't be distracted by credible or incredible or non-credible or whatever. We're talking about whose head geek gets padlocked here. Dead serious stuff.
Thank you, Senator Schiffer. Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, it is dead serious stuff. There's no doubt about it. However, in reading the different, and you can go online, and I can show you where to go, and there are several of these cases that have been out in the past, and I can show you a geologist report that says the assumptions used in this model were unrealistic and that the data collected was inaccurate. And yet, based on unrealistic assumptions and inaccurate data, somebody's water right was shut off. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, I think that we need a higher standard than that. I really do. And so, now, if you're willing to say that that's a standard that we should live with, of unrealistic assumptions and inaccurate data to shut somebody's water off, then you should be real comfortable voting no on this bill. Now, if you think that that you should have credible data and you should have some accurate data before someone's water is shut off, then I submit to you, you should probably vote for this bill. And it's just as simple as that.
Thank you, Senator Barr. Senator Bernard.
I have some questions about this. I'm kind of new at this, but if the state engineer has to perform a study to find out where the credible water comes from, who pays for that? Does that individual pay for that, or is that paid for by the state of Wyoming? And if the state of Wyoming pays for that, then I can't see where there's not going to be some kind of fiscal responsibility and some somebody's costs. So could you please address that?
Certainly.
Senator Meyer.
When there's a call for interference or a request for interconnection, normally there's a $100 fee for the person who wants to ask that determination. And that's just filed with the state engineer. And then what normally happens is that the state engineer will look to see whether or not there's enough data already derived, because the state engineer goes out, has a lot of different test wells and stuff in different areas, has a lot of data that he can draw from the USGS as far as rain flows and different things like that. A lot of data is already out there. When they want to do a real good study, they do what they did a couple years ago, is that they come through the legislature and they request through the water development, select water normally, goes through our process, and then the state engineer has appropriated those funds. And those studies can normally cost between $100,000 and $150,000. And those funds are sufficient in practically all cases to derive the data that's necessary to make a reasonable decision or a reasonable determination. So, yes, there is a cost to that. These are things that don't happen every year. I think I went online, and I think I was able to pull up three, maybe four of them over the course of the last 25 or 30 years. That, I hope, answers your question.
Further discussion on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and again, I remind the Senate that I do have a conflict on, but let me explain what happened in our area. Quite a few years ago, I think it was 1979, the United States Geological Survey came in and did a study. I think the state may have been involved in that, but they drilled a number of test wells. I have no idea how much it cost. And based on the data that they got from that, they produced a model that said, given how far they had a model that would, so they could plug in how many feet the well was from the creek, say what the conductivity was based on what they'd learned with these test holes and the water levels in them, and say how long it would take that well to draw down the surface right. And it was modeled. Now, you know, yeah, I'm convinced, absolutely convinced, that my creek got dried up by the wells. But that was the worst drought we've had in a long time, too. Drought obviously contributed. How do you prove one way or the other? The thing that causes me to feel I have a conflict is I'm afraid that with this language, some of the wealthy neighbors will be able to do a specific study that will show what they want it to. You can design one of those studies to show what you want to, in part. And they'll claim this is credible data and the other isn't credible. And I got there's a court case, an expensive court case. And what the attorney told me was that you can spend as much as you want to on underground water, because since you can't see it, it's awful hard to prove something conclusively. So you have to use these modelings. And this changes the law. Again, I feel I've got a big personal interest in this. Can't vote on it for just that reason.
For the discussion, Senator Meyer.
Well, thank you. And one thing I did neglect when I put the bill forward, too, is that in some of the memos that have been coming back between the state engineer and the hydrologist that I've seen, is that I'm led to believe that they're looking for one statewide model for the whole state that has no site-specific data. And I think that would be very problematic if we do that. As far as reaching down and seeing the underground water, there's actually some new technology out now that's being used, similar to seismology. And the study that they did in the Horse Creek drainage area, you could have actually mapped that and got a 3D seismologist report just on the hydrology down the 1,200 feet for approximately the same cost as what they're looking at a hydrologist to do the modeling. So as the technology improves, you're actually able to look down into the aquifer, find out exactly where the alluvial formations are, find out where the broken brule formations are, where your unpermeable layers are. And so you have that modeling. I don't know if anybody's seen the 3D modeling that we have on secondary oil recovery, but you can basically do the same thing on water. So the new technologies are out there. They're getting cheaper all the time, and those technologies exist to be able to look at that. So I'm actually hoping that we can move this forward so we don't have one model across the whole state in all circumstances, because that would just not reflect what happens in each one of these different drainages.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 136, say aye. Opposed, say no.
No.
That bill has failed, Committee of the Whole. Need a standing vote? We do need a standing vote. All those in favor, please stand.
Thank you.
All those opposed, please stand. Pursuant to Senate Rules 11-5, having failed a standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Barnard?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
Dockstader?
No.
Driscoll?
No.
Amrick?
No.
Esquivel? Geis?
No.
Hastert? Hicks?
Aye.
Hines?
No.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
No.
Martin?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Nutting?
No.
Perkins?
No.
Peterson?
No.
Ross?
No.
Rothfuss?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott? Conflict? Von Flatron?
No.
President Anderson?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 2 ayes, 27 noes, 1 conflict.
Senate File 136, having failed a roll call vote pursuant of Senate Rules 11-5a, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 137. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 137, Ignition Interlock Devices, an act relating to the operation of motor vehicles, sponsored by Senator Perkins. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the Senate file. What is your pleasure? Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor. Sorry to interrupt here, but we have a couple of folks here that I'd like to introduce. It's from our National Park Service. Sitting up here, Regional Director John Wessels for the Intermountain Region out of Colorado, and our good friend, Mary Gibson Scott, who's a superintendent of Grand Teton National Park. And if I could just say that in Wyoming we talk about loyalty and riding for the brand, and I'd have to tell you, in the years of working with Superintendent Scott, she has been true to riding for the brand for Teton National Park and has been a great steward.
Thank you. Welcome to the Wyoming Senate. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee whole rise and report that do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 137. If with your indulgence, I'll go ahead and explain the bill, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, what this does is a few years ago we had passed a provision through here that required ignition interlocks in the event of certain circumstances in relation to drunk driving convictions. In the 2 years since we passed that bill, there's been a couple of weaknesses that have appeared, and working with the Department of Transportation Driver Services Division, identified those and come back to try and fix two of the problems that existed or that appear to exist in the administration and implementation of this program. What we've got, those two problems are addressed in the following ways. First of all, if you go to page 2 of the bill and look at lines 4 and 5, what you have is the language initially was for a first conviction where the conviction is based upon the person having an alcohol concentration of 15 hundredths or 0.15. That's what the existing language is now. What that has done is create an issue and some confusion in how this is administered. The Ignition interlock is part of the administrative process of the Department of Transportation. It has to do with suspension. And ultimately, what happens if you get a DUI, there's a criminal side, and then there's an administrative side. The criminal side is in the court. The administrative side is there's a hearing, or the opportunity for a hearing with the Department of Transportation, where they're able to make certain findings and determine if your license should be suspended. And the ignition interlock allows you to shorten that suspension, provided that you drive with an ignition interlock in your vehicle, and there's a stamp that goes on your driver's license and so on and so forth. The problem that's happened in this is that when we have it's based upon a conviction, when the department goes back to try and require that ignition lock be installed, unless the .15 is in the judgment and sentence of conviction that comes out of the criminal action, there's not a basis for them to impose the ignition interlock on first offenders with a .15 or greater blood alcohol content. Barring that, if it's a jury trial, you would have to have a special jury interrogatory. Most time a jury, it comes back and it's guilty or not guilty. To implement this the way the language is now, that they're looking for most judges and other people are looking for a special finding from the jury that would find, the jury would have to find that the blood alcohol was 0.15 or greater, and that's not happening. So what this does is this helps consolidate this so that it becomes truly purely an administrative issue. And so what you have is the department's administrative action indicates that the person had an alcohol concentration. That is the part of the hearing that would be part of the suspension issues and whether or not they can impose the requirement that a ignition interlock be installed in a vehicle. They would have to come back and prove during the administrative hearing that you had a 0.15 blood alcohol content or greater in order to order the ignition interlock. So it clears up that. The other issue that it also addresses is on lines 11 through 16. The other loophole or the other problem that arose is when and how this time runs. For example, in a first offense, you have an ignition lock that the requirement under the law is that it be imposed for 6 months. When you have that, you have out of the criminal action, there are individuals who are getting, they may even get their ignition interlocks early before they even come to court, and then they want credit for time served with the ignition interlock in their car, or they come out of there, the judge orders them to have an ignition interlock as a part of the criminal proceeding. They come out of there, and so they have an ignition interlock. When it finally gets around to the administrative services and division of YDOT where they administer this, that may be as much as 45 days after the conviction is over. So you may be half of the suspension period or more is over. These individuals have had ignition locks in their vehicles, and there's no reporting that's going to the department for follow up on whether or not the ignition interlock, whether or not these individuals are trying to drive their cars and blowing 1.5s still driving and failing to the ignition interlock because there's no download to the department. So what this does is makes it part of the administrative action. It would run from when the administrative sanction is imposed, and so it would be clear to everyone when the suspension and the ignition lock period starts and when it ends, and that's what that does. The other side is makes it for adults, and then the rest of the bill applies it also to underage drivers in the same situation. I bring that to you for your consideration and ask for your favorable consideration. Would stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion on the bill. Question being called. There's no further discussion. All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 137, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. That Senate file has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 138. The reading clerk will read in the Senate file.
Senate File 138, Child Custody Orders Abandonment and Act Relating to Parental Rights, sponsored by Senator Perkins. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Perkins. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
For the last time today, Mr. Chairman, I move that when this committee, the whole rising reports that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 138. Senate File 138 brings back something I tried to deal with last year. It passed out of this body, but ultimately did not make it into law. What we're trying to do here is is try and create a situation where what I perceive to be individuals in the same situation can get the same kind of relief. This has to do with termination of parental rights. And to probably best explain this, if I go back to what our Supreme Court has done with some cases, they have determined that, and this whole thing has to do with a little bit of background, in 14.2309, which is the statute's being changed, you're talking about grounds for termination of a parent-child relationship. And in subsection A of that, it starts out, and there are about six or seven different ways to terminate parental relationships. And we're always dealing with Romanet 1. In Romanet 1, there's a threshold question. If you go to the language at the top of page 2, it says the child has been left in the care of another person. That provision, which a child has been left in the care of another person, has been the subject of a number of Supreme Court cases that find this. The child has been left in the care of another person. We note that the children, anyway, long story short, is what happens. The court has determined this, that under this, the threshold question is the court must determine whether the child has been left without provision for support rather than whether the parent has willfully failed to support the child. In fact, the case, it appears that minor children in this case, two minor children were placed in the custody of the appellant by a court that granted a divorce. The children were not left in the care of another, but were placed there by a court order. So the court is looking and saying that if there's any kind of order that places custody of the child with one parent, that the other parent cannot have left that child in custody, and therefore, no matter what, that parent would never be able to have the absentee father or the absentee mother's rights terminated because that child has been not left but placed in the care of the other person. I have two individuals in my, two constituents in my district that are both in this situation. Both of them are young women who were married, unmarried, had children out of wedlock. The fathers are there, and neither one of the fathers signed affidavits stating that they were the father of the child. In both of these cases, the fathers are well aware, but the fathers have been nowhere to be found since the child's birth. These children are now, one of them is three and the other one's two. And the child's never been around. The father's never been around to see the child. The mothers in both these cases would like to terminate the parental rights of the father, but can't, because what they have to do is they will have to go get a paternity order finding these individuals as their fathers in order to terminate their rights. When they go and do that, there will be an order of custody placing that child in the custody of the mother. Once that child's placed in the custody of that mother, then that child cannot have been left and abandoned. Our Supreme Court has said, in looking at that, they have said that the legislature appears to have concurred with this interpretation. When the court interprets a statute and the legislature makes no material legislative change in the provision of thereafter, the legislature is presumed to have acquiesced in the court's finding. So the intent of this bill and the purpose is to allow the court to look at the facts, to really look and see whether or not the child's been left without provision for support and for at least a period of 1 year, and in making the and without communication, the parent has neither provided support or provided any significant communication with 1 year. It's trying to let the court look at that question and decide that. And so what this does and what the bill does is simply adds this sentence in lines 7 through 9. For purposes of this paragraph, a court order of custody shall not preclude a finding that the child has been left in the care of another person. Hopefully what we're trying to tell the court is, we don't agree with your interpretation. A child can be left in the care of another even if there's a court order that places him there. And so with that, I'll stand for questions, and that's the explanation of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Further discussion on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I think I understand the evil and the unfortunate nature of the court decision that we're seeking to deal with here. But does our remedy leave us open to the opposite problem, where somebody is denied access to their child because of a court placement, and because probably of the action of the person who has the custody of the child. And we're therefore opening a easy way for the exact opposite problem, which is somebody being just shut out of access to and right, parental rights over the child when they have no intention of abandoning them. And I don't know enough about the law in this area, and I don't understand this bill well enough to know whether that's a problem or not. But I would ask the Senate, and particularly those in the Senate that know a lot more about this area than I do, to take a look at this and make sure we aren't just, in fixing one problem, we aren't creating the opposite one.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And along the line of that, the good tall senator from Natrona County, I know I have a particular individual who had custody of the child, and the parent had, a month and a half custody during the summer, but was at another state. And once the child left the state, he couldn't get that child returned to the state. And it would go into the incidental contacts and communications, because the non-custodial parent was limiting the contacts and communications. And our court system could not get the court in another state to take jurisdiction of the matter and to return the child back. And it's almost to the point where it's a parental kidnapping. But I'd like to have a better comfort level of this, because it seems like we could almost be empowering situations like that for that person if it was a person in our state and the custodial parent was in another state, empowering that person to gain legal custody when they may or may not have any right at all.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What you have in this particular statute is there are a number of ways to seek parental rights under the statute. One is the one we're talking about here. The next paragraph talks about the children has been abandoned with no means of identification for at least 3 months, and efforts to locate parents have been unsuccessful. The child's been abused or neglected by a parent. Parents incarcerated is another one. Child's been in foster care and the responsibility of the state of Wyoming for 15 of the most recent 22 months. There's another one. Child's abandoned for less than 1 year of age and has been abandoned for at least 6 months. The child's been dropped off at a safe haven. You've got a parent's convicted of murder or homicide. Other types of convictions. But anyway, so we get back, and what we're looking at here and what this bill attempts to do is simply let the court get past the threshold question of whether or not the child's been left in the care of another. It still allows the court to look for, one, has there been provision for the child support made? If there's been provision for the child support made, then you're not going to qualify for termination of parental rights with or without a custody order. The other one says, and without communication from the absent parent. So there has to be no communication. So if you haven't tried to make telephone calls, if you haven't sent birthday cards, if you haven't tried to communicate, or the things like that. So it's a two-pronged test. Both of those have to be satisfied for a period of 1 year. And the only thing the court can do, the only thing the legislature has instructed the court to do, is in making the above determination, the court may disregard occasional contributions or incidental contacts or communications. And there's a somewhat of a body of case law that deals with that. So, but if you're providing for this, if there's a court order and you're paying your support and you're trying to make, and making communication, you can't have your parental rights terminated. And so what this does is this, what we're trying to do here is allow the court to get to the question. So regardless of whether the parent has a, because what it really comes down to, has the parent abandoned this child? and allows the court to look and see at the real facts and see if the child's been abandoned. And the abandonment is basically in this statute been defined as no support or communication and no communication for 1 year. So it's a two-pronged test, both prongs having to be satisfied. When I look at that situation and look at my constituents, to me it's unfathomable to believe that those individuals that I would find a mother and a child who've been abandoned, essentially by a parent, that one of them can get relief in almost the exact same circumstance that the other one can't, simply because there's a court order that places that child in the custody of another, that places that child in the custody of the parent. I think it's, you know, to me, I don't understand how a child cannot be abandoned simply because the court can say whatever it wants, but the child's either being provided for and communicated with or it's not. And hopefully what the intent of this bill is to get to that and let the court make that substantive determination as opposed to a technical one that says, oh, sorry, you've got a court order, we're not hearing your case today.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Senator Bebout.
Chairman, just a question. You talked about if the father is nowhere to be seen and abandoned him. What if the father has not done that and he wishes to see his child and he can never have access to it because of the situation where the court has placed custody with the mother? The mother never admitted that he was a father, never allowed anything to be done to go in that direction to determine that he was a father. So here's the father, knowing, at least in his own mind, that he's a father of that child, has no access to the courts to be able to visit or even see it.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In doing that, I think that you go back and you look at what the court looks, what the court's requirement is. Has it been left in the care of another person? In that case, I think that what you're talking about is, regardless of a court order, has that person truly been left? That requires some act or inaction on behalf of that parent. And I would submit to you that if someone, two things, or first of all, if someone didn't know he was the father, I was going to say he or she was the father, but if someone didn't know that he was the father, you know, it's going to be awfully hard when there is a, obviously notice has to be provided, the father or the parent for whom parental rights are sought to be terminated. They have to be noted, and they're a party to this law. They're a party to any legal action regarding their rights, and requires for personal service. Unless you can't find them, you have to, and if there's some other ways to serve if you can't find or don't know where that person is. But ultimately, if the identity or even the existence of the child has been concealed from the parent, and then the parent finds out about it, I think you're going to be hard pressed to say that child was left in the care of even the custodial parent, because how can I leave it when I never knew about it? So I think that they don't meet that threshold question. All we're talking about here is not saying the court can't look at that, but just that alone doesn't stop the court from getting to the issues, has this child been abandoned? And parental rights are very significant rights. Courts take them very seriously. And I don't see a parent being fast and loose, trying to play fast and loose with the facts and either hiding or concealing the existence of a child or preventing contact, those things. I don't see a court looking at that and saying, well, I'm sorry, yeah, you haven't. I don't see a court meeting, or I don't see those facts as meeting that threshold. Will there be cases of injustice? There are cases of injustice now. Courts don't always get it right. Judges are human. But I don't think this in of itself enhances the probability of that injustice being done any more than the injustices that are being done by not having this provision in the bill.
Thank you, Senator Perkins. Further discussion on the bill. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 138, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no.
No.
Senate File 138 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 1.
Oh, excuse me. This is Joint Resolution 1. Reading clerk will read in the Joint Resolution.
Senate Joint Resolution 1, Right to Hunt, Fish, and Trap, a joint resolution proposing to amend the Wyoming Constitution by recognizing and preserving the heritage of Wyoming citizens' opportunity to harvest wild birds, fish, and game, sponsored by Senator Hicks. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, Christensen, Dockstader, Driscoll. No, Senator Escobel. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure?
That's me.
Senator Burns.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. I was in another time zone. Good to be back. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation that Senate Joint Resolution 1 pass Committee of the Whole. And there are no standing amendments. I take that back. There is a standing committee amendment, and I ask that it be read in now.
Senate Joint Resolution 1, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 3.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Standing Committee amendment, and with a further explanation of the Senate Joint Resolution, I ask that you call on Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate Joint Resolution Number 1, and I would like to discuss this amendment because it is germane to the bill. I have provided a handout to everybody that tracks these changes. The rationale from this is because this is a proposed constitutional amendment. If you look at that, it says a working copy reflects standing committee amendments. But I want to go through these real quick and then maybe have some discussion on the bill after the amendment, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number, or on line one, excuse me, page 1, line 3. After citizens, it says delete balance of a line and insert right to hunt, trap, right to hunt, fish for, and trap wildlife. You will find that language consistent through the rest of the bill. If you'll turn to page 2, again, it inserts that language, the right to hunt, fish for, and trap wildlife. In line 3, we move down to line 5, it says after state, it's inserts, subject to regulation as prescribed by law. If we move further down, it changes the word to, deletes the word diminish and changes that to alter. That line also deletes the words wild bird fish and inserts again the language to preserve Wyoming's hunting, fishing, and trapping heritage. And then you can read the actual language that would be on the ballot, assuming that this proposed amendment does pass this body. And again, it inserts the words right to hunt, fish for, and trap wildlife, subject to regulations as prescribed by law. Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the amendment at this time and then entertain discussion on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, Mr. Chairman, I've never been accused of having a real good grasp on the English language, but when we say the right to hunt, fish for, and trap wildlife, does that mean I can only fish for them, but I can't catch them?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, at the present time, I don't have my Webster's handy, but that wasn't certainly the intent. The intent is to hunt multiple with the comma, meaning an and or, fish for, and trap for wildlife. So it would include all those activities.
Thank you. We are on the amendment. Questions or discussions on the amendment? Senator Ross.
Question, Mr. Chairman. are fish wildlife? I mean, or can you fish for bear?
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, fish are wildlife.
Further discussion on the amendment. Are you ready for the question on the amendment? Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number one to joint Senate Joint Resolution number one, please say aye. Opposed, no? Yeah, the amendment has passed. Back on the bill. Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to address the body, and I want to run through a brief history of this and hopefully dispel some of the myth that this is just a truly feel-good measure. We all believe in this, but what is what's the basis for this? And a little bit of talk about what the threats were then and the threats today that we face associated with this. And then what I'd like to do is capture, because we've had 3 weeks of pretty good discussion on why we would constitutionalize anything in the Wyoming State Constitution. I'd like to share with you 9 observations that I've made over the last 2 weeks. But I handed out a handout last Friday to the body, and it's a very extensive legal review of the history of right to fish and hunt. And you also have a handout here that says SR1, right to hunt and fish. And just a brief history. This goes back to the very nature of Western history. You can find clauses all the way back into the Romans that talk about the right to access and trap wildlife. All the way up to the point is one of the most egregious things in early England was the fact that the crown claimed the wildlife. And it was a fundamental thing that happened. And the signing of the Magna Carta was to give the average person access to that wildlife. And that was in 1215. Following up that continued to expand upon those rights was the Charter of the Forest that was done in 1217 in England. There was another one because the Crown continued to exert their authority over wildlife that, again, it had to come back and restore that right back to the people. It was in 1671 called the Britain Game Act. And then probably the thing that's most pertinent to us as a people in the United States, when the colonies came over, in almost every single colonial charter, there was a provision for the free taking of wildlife, because that was stripped from the citizenry of England. It was only reserved to the privileged. It was so important to those people, those colonies, to have that free right of taking that is in almost every colonial charter. And along those lines, to give you more illustrations of how important this is, not only to the state of Wyoming, but our history, and to have a good understanding of our history. When we first declared our independence from Europe and from England, 1776, Pennsylvania put it in their original constitutional charter, right to hunt and fish and fowl. 1777, Vermont enacted in their original constitution, the right to hunt and fish. That language that was in 1777 is still there today, and it's withstood the test of time. I would tell you that this was such a concern of the citizenry in 1776 all the way up to the Continental Congress that there was 200 proposed amendments to the United States Constitution. James Madison, one of the principal framers of our Constitution today, considered one that was sent from Pennsylvania. And I'm just going to read it real quick. It says, "The inhabitants of several states shall have the liberty to fowl and hunt in seasonable times on lands they hold and on all other lands in the United States not enclosed." Even back then, they wanted to protect private property rights. I'm not going to read the rest of this. Obviously, Madison didn't put it in the Constitution. But what he did basically say is they reserved this right to the states. It is an absolute fundamental right of the states to be able to do this. The threat then was the king's deer. The people had lost access to wildlife. So we don't have a king nowadays. There's no real threat, or at least there's no real perceived threat. But you have to ask yourself, if you look at those list of states, 13 states have done this. And many of these in the last 10 years. 3 last year went on the ballot. 3 constitutional amendments in the United States. Tennessee, Arkansas, and South Carolina. I will tell you that Wyoming ranks 5th in the nation for the percentage of our population that hunts and fishes. That's higher than any three of those states that passed this constitutional amendment last year. When I went back and I looked at the latest U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service data, over one-third of the population in this state in 2006 held a hunting, fishing, or a trapping, or a multiple combination of those licenses. It is very important to the people of the state of Wyoming. But let's talk to the issue of the threat today. If you'll turn the page and you'll look over, this is a list of all the ballot initiatives that have been proposed in the last 20 years, and it's not a comprehensive list, but it gives you an idea of the new threat out there, and it's a real threat. This is just one of many threats. We've seen banning wolf hunting in Alaska, prescribing the methods of wolf hunting. Our neighbors in Colorado have banned the ability to hunt black bears like we do here in Wyoming. So it's happening right around us, folks. I would also tell you that in the state of Alaska, the federal government has usurped the state's right and in some cases precluded not only Alaskan residents, but U.S. residents from hunting on federal land and reserved those to a small minority up there. So we have one threat out there that's going around the states right now, and that's referendums and ballot initiatives. But probably as big a threat to that, I would like to read something. This was a report at the Association of American Medical Colleges, and it talks about a shift in our judiciary. And it says the shift has yet reached popular opinion. However, in the U.S., social change has and can occur throughout the courts, and in many instances do not operate as a democratic institution. Therefore, the evolution of elite legal opinions is extremely significant. Now, what's that really mean? Well, I'll tell you, the first animal rights course taught in the United States was in Harvard Law School in 2000. Since 2000, there is approximately 120 of the 126 law schools in the United States that now teach at least one class in animal rights, and some of them have a concentration in that area. The American Bar Association now has a committee exclusively for examining animal rights. So not only are we under threat of large, powerful organizations that have a net sum of over $200 million to launch ballot initiatives, assuming we ever get wolves off the list, the next thing that's probably likely to come is a ballot initiative. But we have a continuing move within the judiciary. So when you think about this, there is a present danger out there. Now, if I can shift gears just a little bit, what I'd really like you to do is think about Wyoming for just a moment. Think about the murals, our history and our culture, where we came from, where we are today, and where we're going. And when I look at Wyoming and I look at these murals and I see trappers and Native Americans, the Native Americans were here for one reason. For access to that game, and they fought and died over that access. The trappers came here and settled this country, settled the state of Wyoming. We've got Jim Bridger and John Coulter, part of our historic background. Think about your own county. William Sublette, Sublette County. John Fremont, an early explorer to the west. Bighorn County. Laramie County, Laramie River. Was named after an early trapper, French trapper named Laramie. We've got towns named Fort Bridger, Cody, Buffalo Bill, Grable, Wapiti, Elk Basin. This is who we are as a state. We wouldn't name our towns and our counties after our heritage if that heritage wasn't important to move that forward. So what I'd like to do is run through real quick. Nine items that I think and that I'd like to capture that we talked about constitutionalization and why we would do that in a state constitution. So let me take a real quick run at this. State constitutions confer rights that the federal constitution does not address and authorize remedies that the federal constitution never contemplated and wasn't intended to contemplate. Two, state constitutions have long been understood as a potential source of more substantial rights than the federal constitution. State constitutions are a rich source and a substantive provision that reflects public policy. Policy for the state of Wyoming. States have developed a distinct political communities and qualities formed in part by our own unique history. The reason Wyoming has a constitution that's different in Colorado's because we're fundamentally different people. And it's based not only on our history, our geography, our economy, and our demographics. So our Constitution doesn't have to look like the other states. It should be something different, and it should reflect who we are. It's that very identity of a people is what that Constitution is supposed to reflect. State constitutions provide a forum for protecting and promoting the values of the state of Wyoming. That's what a state constitution is supposed to do. We constitutionalize in some cases because of the electorate, the people. The people have a profound distrust of government, of courts, of legislatures, and administrative agencies. Isn't that just what we debated this morning? The distrust of the federal government to continue handing things down. So this is one of the reasons we may want to constitutionalize. The constitutional issues of public concerns, it provides the energy behind these constitutional amendments come from the people. It's important to the people to amend our Constitution. That's one of the other things. And here's probably one of the things. By enshrining anything, hunting, fishing, and trapping rights in our Constitution, it's a way of expressing the importance of these issues to us as a people, and preserving and protecting these activities a significant part of who we are. That's why we would want to put anything in our Constitution. This is the most important thing, and I don't want to miss this. The very reason that we have constitutions, people, the very sole reason is to prevent change. To embed certain rights in such a manner that future generations are bound by those decisions. Those decisions are made by the people. This body can only say, we're going to let the people vote, or we're not going to let them vote. But if the people of Wyoming today want to bind the future generation, then the only way they have to do that is through our Constitution. Members of the Senate, I ask you on this important issue to the state of Wyoming, let the people decide. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hicks. There will be a test on that history lesson tomorrow. Further discussion on the bill. We're on the bill. Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. Once again, this is probably the biggest right that citizens of Wyoming's got that's not a right. It's not in the Constitution that we can do it. And under many states now, it's under attack. And this is a critical component of Wyoming's heritage and history, as Larry pointed, Senator Hicks pointed out. I would really urge you strongly to preserve this piece forever for Wyoming and support it.
Thank you, Senator. For the discussion, Senator Von Flattern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have nothing to say against the philosophy that's embedded in this document. I mean, I agree. I hunt. I understand that. But to take what may be threats, and may be real threats, I mean, I've heard the rumblings, I've seen the lawsuits. But every time we think there's a threat to our way of life or our freedom of choice, we want to change our Constitution. As I said earlier, that document's been around for a long time. It's done us pretty well. So to go up here at whatever issue is perceived to be under attack, that may be something that we do on a regular basis and think that it should be saved for us and that we shouldn't have anybody tell us how to do something and then go to our Constitution and change it to protect us, I think is wrong. I think we should manage our wildlife the way we do, be the pride of this nation in how we manage our wildlife. But I don't think we should change our Constitution. Someday somebody's going to suggest that we change it, that your choice of vehicle should be protected in the Constitution when there's a perceived threat that electric vehicles might be taking over, and you don't want to drive an electric vehicle. So this it's a big moment to change your Constitution, and I cannot see changing it at this moment to look like, well, in 18 months we'll have a ballot out there in front of everybody that look like a Colorado ballot. You know, there'll be 6 and 8 things to choose from. I don't think this is a good idea.
Thank you, Senator Von Flattern. For the discussion, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, it does seem to me appropriate that given what's happening in our society, I don't think it'll spread here the next 5, 10, I don't know how long, years. But I think now is a good time to take the precaution, because this is part of our lifestyle, and I think it is well worth preserving. And I think the threat that we have seen in other states with what wealthy groups and individuals can do with the initiative process should give us some cause to be careful here and support this. Mr. Chairman, having said that, I have a question on some of the specific language, and I'm working off this working copy that reflects standing committee amendments. And, Mr. Chairman, I thank the sponsor or whoever put this together, because this is extraordinarily useful in understanding what we're doing. The concern I have is on lines 8 and 9. We say it does not alter the duty of the state to manage wildlife in such, and we ought to remove the such, in a manner that ensures adequate populations and sustained use. And then we say to preserve Wyoming's hunting, fishing, and trapping heritage. And that's fine. That's clearly one of the reasons we're wanting to have the sustained population. You don't have the sustained populations, you can't hunt them, as a practical matter. But are we disparaging other reasons to have a sustained wildlife population? Right now, there's considerable effort made in the state to protect the sage-grouse populations, partly because we hunt them, and people say they're good eating, and it's part of our hunting heritage. But also partly because if we don't protect them, we have major threats to the economic viability of particularly our minerals industry, where inadequate populations will lead to restrictions on our land use. And that's a perfectly valid reason, when you look at the practicalities, to try to ensure adequate wildlife populations. And my question then is, does that last sentence to preserve Wyoming's, or last clause, to preserve Wyoming's hunting and fishing, trapping heritage need to be there? And does its presence in any way limit what we can do and the reasons we have for preserving some of our other wildlife populations? Or would we be best putting a period after sustained use and removing that last clause? Because with the clause removed, then you wouldn't have to say why you were doing it. You know, everybody knows you need to do it to sustain your population, but there's some other reasons too.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following in my tall colleague's footsteps here on that same area, I wonder if this couldn't also be interpreted a little bit different by the Game and Fish Department. I wonder if the Game and Fish Department wouldn't be looking at, now we have a constitutional requirement to ensure adequate populations, and we turn them loose with choosing what those adequate enough populations are. I think it's dangerous to leave that in there. And so I would say, let's back up the tall senator's period just a little bit, but let's not stop there, because do we really need to go in and say that it doesn't create a right to trespass? That's a different right, and that's a different place. I don't think that we need to say it, but I do think that we need to say, to make this a strong document, it's the right to hunt and fish and trap for wildlife. But I have a problem. Not that I don't like Game and Fish. I think they do a wonderful job. But I think someplace down the road we could have somebody misinterpret that and kind of go wild with the sustaining of the populations.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I would look at the suggestion from this tall, lanky senator over here from Natrona County as a favorable amendment. I would also like to address my other Natrona County senator's comments. And I think if you move back up to get to the question is does that provide an affirmative right for the department? If you go up there and it says, in line four, it says, the state subject to regulation as prescribed by law. Only the legislature can write law. So their regulations have to conform with whatever laws that are promulgated within the legislature. So it gets to that issue of it doesn't convey any more authority or power to the department to write regulations, because those regulations are only tiered off of the laws wrote by the Wyoming legislature and adopted.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Escobill.
Mr. Chairman, I guess, you know, the concern that I have is that, you know, with our constitutional rights, such as the right to free speech, normally when any type of rule or regulation is enacted that limits free speech, it's usually strictly scrutinized. It really is tested harshly. You know, so I was wondering, in regard to this proposed constitutional amendment, you know, it says the right to hunt, et cetera, subject to regulation as prescribed by laws. And I was wondering if that statement itself brings it to less than a strict scrutiny. It seems like it weakens the whole argument of constitutional rights, and possibly some of my colleagues who are more versed in constitutional law might want to voice their support or opposition to my comments. I'm not sure, but
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, if you would turn to our Constitution, and under Article 1, you see similar such language under Section 6. It states, without due process of law. Section 8, it talks about the legislature may elect or may direct, may by law direct. Section 9, again, references the legislature may change or regulate. So, this is not inconsistent with numerous other provisions within our existing Constitution.
Further questions or discussion? Senator Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on that, that portion was very carefully drafted with Game and Fish help and looking at other states, and it was done specifically for the reason to be able to enforce laws so that there was no blanket right to be able to do it for criminals or people that did it wrong. This bill is really, as far as cutting pieces off or changing it, it's pretty tried and true. It stands very close, similar language in other states that have passed and have held up the scrutiny of time on the constitutional amendment. And that by itself helps it stand, in my opinion. The more you meddle with it, it's been very carefully thought out with all involved.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That said, and I appreciate the words from the Northeast, but I appreciate the work that our fellow senator has done on this. My heritage certainly is all about everything that this says. I just keep getting hung up with the language, the right to hunt, fish for, and trap wildlife. Fish for is a modifier to wildlife. And I got to be honest, I grew up in a household where my father became the supervisor of the western half of the state in fisheries, and I've never heard of fish being classified as wildlife. For some reason, I'm just getting hung up on language. So I guess I would turn to the tall senator from Natrona County and say, if we're going to look at the language, maybe we can, you know, if we're going to go to a constitutional amendment here, I just want to make sure that we're saying what we need to say and saying it the best way we can. So, thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the work that's gone into this and the thought in respect to our heritage and trying to look forward into the future. I'd encourage the body think about moving this forward from committee of the whole to give that opportunity for some amendment language to specifically target some of these issues, and maybe we can refine and work this out to something that works for the group. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, in response to my colleague's comments on fishing for wildlife, I think the meaning is plain and clear. I think the fish for is a product of the way we use those words in the English language. I think it makes all kinds of sense, and I think the courts will understand exactly what we mean and interpret it correctly. So, Mr. Chairman, I do think that language is correct the way it's written.
Thank you. Are you ready for the question? Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate Joint Resolution Number 1, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Senate Joint Resolution has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Motion carries.
Let me clean up my mess here.
Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate file 95, do pass amended. Senate file 132, do pass. Senate file 134, do pass amended. Senate file 136, failed to pass committee of the whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate file 137, do pass. Senate file 138, do pass. And Senate joint resolution 1, do pass amended. Senator Peterson, chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for adoption of the committee of the whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. That motion is carried. That report has been adopted. We do have some reports from standing committees.
February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 70, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flatern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 1st, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 118, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass, amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flatern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, February 2nd.
Announcements, Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land and Water Resources, we'll meet in about 10 minutes, and we're going to take up House Bill 8, Engrossed Wyoming Traditional Food Act, House Bill 15, Engrossed Weed and Pest Control, House Bill 57, Feral Livestock, and House Bill 18, Engrossed Quarantine of Animals.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in the normal committee room. We're posted Senate File 145, Medicaid Fraud Recovery, Senate File 49, Denturists. We're going to reverse the order and do the denturists first. Mr. President, the announcement says that proposed amendments to Senate File 145 are available to interested parties in the committee room. Add to that the proposed amendments to the denturist bill will be available shortly in the committee room.
Other announcements, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. President, your Transportation Committee will meet Wednesday, February 2nd, 10 minutes after adjournment in room S14. We will take up House Bill 41, engrossed, driving within a single lane, and House Bill 124, engrossed, National Guard, emergency deployment professional licensing.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number one, Judiciary, tomorrow on Wednesday, February the 2nd at 8 a.m. in room S21 will consider the following bills. House Bill 105, Temporary Military Duty, Child Custody and Visitation. House Bill 68, Violent Felony Definition Expansion. House Bill 19, Assignment of Retired Circuit Court Judges.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, will meet tomorrow, Wednesday, February 2nd, 15 minutes after noon recess in room S18 to continue discussion on Senate File 105, State Control of Certain Land, House Bill 108, Engrossed Collection Agencies, and House Bill 112, Engrossed Mining Permits.
Other announcements? Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet about 15 minutes after adjournment to take up the action on the state-funded construction projects, preference provisions, Senate File 144, and complete work on Senate File 107, energy-impacted county roads programs. Tomorrow, Mr. President, the committee number 2 will meet beginning at 8 a.m. to consider the following re-referred bills, Senate File 29, Developmental Disability Services, Senate File 125, Healthcare Facilities Crisis Management, Senate File 139, Healthcare Pilot Project Amendments, Senate File 121, Performance-Based Evaluation and Design, and Senate File 143, Federal Natural Resource Policy.
Any other announcements? Seeing none, you heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion is carried. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m., tomorrow morning, February the 2nd, Senate is adjourned.